Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Wyoming's second largest industry, travel and hospitality, tries to navigate legal immigrants to compensate for the decreasing available local workforce.
We hire all the locals that we possibly can that are employable, and it's not enough.
A lengthy battle between Campbell County and a coal company has ended with few happy, but it could lead to a change in laws around ad valorem taxes.
Wyoming farmers and nutrition groups around the state are collaborating to solve the problems of hunger and a lack of access to healthy foods.
We have roads in rural areas, we have schools in rural areas, we should have food in rural areas.
Those stories in an interview with the Republican candidate for Congress, Rod Miller, on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. A nearly million-dollar legal battle over taxes is now settled, but the underlying issues are not. The dispute between the recently bankrupt Alpha Natural Resources and Campbell County highlighted how certain taxes aren't prioritized in state law, and that means less money to counties and to the state school system. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports some people are fed up and are looking to the legislature for change.
In the second hour of a fluorescently lit Board of Commissioners meeting in Campbell County, Chairman Mark Christensen introduces a new topic.
The long-awaited Alpha Natural Resource payment.
He's audibly relieved to be entering the final step of a lengthy battle with Alpha Natural Resources, which went bankrupt in 2015. The dispute was over the coal company not paying ad valorem taxes, a one-time extraction payment to counties, which fund local services, hospitals, and school systems. In 2016, Alpha owed Campbell County over $20 million, and the county believed they should receive all the taxes owed to them. The other two coal companies that went bankrupt alongside Alpha paid those taxes quickly.
They didn't try to stiff us or stiff anybody else. And then this company looked for every possible loophole they could find.
Alpha doubled down on not paying its debt, and it had a lot of arguments on why they shouldn't. It argued a big chunk of the taxes owed was debt from before filing for bankruptcy, which would return pennies on the dollar. Alpha's position was strengthened by arguing county taxes aren't a priority in debt payment, allowing them to pay their first creditors, banks, at the expense of county taxes. Christensen says he didn't like any of it.
And no other company's ever taken that position because it's always been well established that the taxes came due and they traditionally were paid after the actual product was extracted. I find what they did and tried to do in their behavior a little bit reprehensible.
The settlement allowed Alpha to avoid paying over $4 million in taxes. Of the remaining $11.3 million or so owed, the company agreed to pay $7 million of it. Alpha's Steve Hawkins had little to say in response to all this.
Only thing I could say on behalf of the company is we've gone through the full process of bankruptcy and the case is ready for closure. I think that's about it.
The arguments made by Alpha would not be possible without a few laws that people have been trying to change for years. Ones that have systematically caused counties to lose out on millions. Between 2006 and 2016, 12 counties have missed out on about $42 million. That's according to a report from the Powder River Basin Resource Council. One of the laws enables a slow collection process. Companies don't have to pay ad valorem taxes for up to 18 months. That allows a lot of time for things to go wrong, like, say, bankruptcy. Christensen says monthly collection would have resulted in a lot less back tax from Alpha. The other loophole is a county's lack of priority in the lien process. Most other states have made their taxes superior to all other liens. Here's Christensen again.
This isn't something that's just crept up. That's why we've been trying to address this for such a long time. What's getting worse, though, is at least some of the companies looking for all these loopholes to basically take advantage of it.
Banking and oil and gas lobbyists have been instrumental in preventing changes to these laws. One bill in 2017 tried to move counties to first priority in debt collection. It didn't make it to state Senate, largely from lobbyist pressure. Head of the Petroleum Association of Wyoming, Bruce Hinchey, explains moving county liens ahead of banks would be a problem.
Yeah, that would be a big issue for any mineral, whether it's us or coal or anybody, because then you wouldn't be able to get bank loans if they did that.
There's also been discussion of speeding up the 18-month timeline, which many legislators see as a threat to a company's health. Gillette Representative Scott Clem says changing that would force companies into paying double ad valorem taxes at some point.
That's a huge burden. They're not strong enough within our existing economy to be able to do something like that. And so it really hurts them, and in turn it hurts Wyoming.
But Gillette Senator Michael Von Fladen says if there's a time for a law change, it's now. He sees the Alpha case as the tipping point.
The mines themselves can no longer say, we've always paid our taxes. It's a terrible thing to have to happen, that we lose $4 or $5 million before somebody wakes up and says, oh, wait a minute.
Von Fladen says this is the biggest loss of tax money the county has ever seen. And there's still a lot more unpaid mineral taxes on the book. About $15 million left in Campbell County, over $2 million in Sublette County, and more around the state.
If nothing is done, you will have this reoccurring in next year, 5 years, 10 years from now.
The legislature is expected to discuss the 18-month timeline for ad valorem taxes in a revenue committee hearing in September. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Strong winds blowing through a gap in the Rocky Mountains could generate electricity in Wyoming, and customers in California want to buy it. But wind power is a hard sell in Wyoming, where coal is still king. As part of the World's 50 States project, reporter Jason Margolis has more.
Wyoming's economy is dominated by coal and other fossil fuels. It's this guy's job to move beyond that.
I'm Jeremiah Riemann, and I'm the Director of Economic Diversification Strategy for the Governor of Wyoming, Matt Mead.
Building a diverse state economy beyond fossil fuels and minerals, it'll be a tall order.
Roughly 70% of our state revenue comes from that single source.
That formula has worked. Residents in Wyoming enjoy among the highest per capita GDP in the nation. So there's been some hostility toward new sources of energy that could threaten that.
You know, it's a complicated history with wind. I think you're seeing a change, and certainly we're hearing the message loud and clear as we go through this economic diversification strategy effort that wind and renewables need to be a part of that.
The push toward wind is playing out in a high-rise office building in Denver. The Anschutz Corporation is looking to build a 730-mile transmission line across the American West.
The power generation that can come from this project matches the consumption side in the desert southwest.
Bill Miller, who is overseeing the project, points to a map and the start, 1,000 wind turbines to be built on a ranch in south-central Wyoming.
It starts there and runs a little bit west and then due south into northwest Colorado.
Miller glides his finger across Colorado, Utah, then down past Las Vegas. If all goes according to plan, in 3 years, Miller says the winds of low-population Wyoming will be bringing electricity to where it's needed in California.
To my knowledge, this is the largest transmission line development that has occurred in this country in probably 50 years.
They're looking to harness Wyoming's wind because it's super windy.
It's a little difficult sometimes to stand outside and talk, especially if you have a microphone. You'll pick up that wind blowing.
I met with Robert Godby at a restaurant in the tiny town of Medicine Bow. He directs the Center for Energy Economics and Public Policy at the University of Wyoming. The winds howl here in southeast Wyoming because they're rising at the Continental Divide, then pushing through a gap in the Rocky Mountains.
So if you remember your high school physics class, there's this thing called the Venturi effect, where you narrow something and that naturally speeds up an airflow. And that's really what we have here.
So Wyoming has strong winds, but the state ranks 16th for wind generation. Godby says Wyoming hasn't exactly made things attractive for developers.
We have the only wind generation tax in the country where we actually tax people who produce electricity with wind.
Many other states are creating incentives for wind development.
I think it's really unfair that Wyoming has this reputation for being hostile to wind or anti-wind.
Jason Beggar defends the state's wind tax.
It's not an anti-wind sort of philosophy, it's just the philosophy of the state, is we tax our natural resources to fund government.
Bager directs the Wyoming Infrastructure Authority, a state entity tasked with developing large transmission projects. He says it's tough to build here because roughly half of Wyoming is federally owned land.
So when you go to Texas or you go to Iowa, you're generally just negotiating with a landowner, you know, whether it's a farmer or whoever. Well, in Wyoming, yeah, you have to file permits with the federal government, and that includes things land use, wildlife mitigation, mineral disturbances. You know,
Bager says the Trump administration has shown a willingness to cut red tape and move things along more quickly. Environmentalists have bristled at the rollback of regulations. Another challenge facing Wyoming wind: climate change skepticism. Coal burns dirty and produces a lot of greenhouse gases. Many states are pushing renewable energy to move away from that. But in Wyoming, it's complicated, explains economist Robert Godby.
So climate change is a pretty tough subject to talk about with some people because it's a threat no matter how you look at it. It's a threat to world climate. It's also a threat to people's livelihoods. And those two things are kind of in conflict. If you're a state like Wyoming, where you produce so much fossil fuel, in particular coal, that's threatened by any sort of climate change policy we might put in place to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Wyoming's governor is one who professes skepticism on climate science, but not on the markets, which are moving away from dirtier burning fuels like coal. And that's why he's pushing for a more diversified economy. At the end of the day, the debate in Wyoming is really about jobs. Wind projects in Wyoming won't come anywhere close to creating enough work to replace the coal industry. But Jeremiah Reeman at the governor's mansion says wind jobs are still a part of the state's broader diversification strategy.
Roughly 60% of our youth between the ages of 18 and 24 will not be here 10 years from now. And that's a trend we would like to see disappear.
Whether new opportunities come from digging up coal or harnessing the wind, for job seekers in Wyoming, that detail may be of secondary importance. For The World, Jason Margolis, Cheyenne, Wyoming.
That story comes to us courtesy of PRI's The World. When we come back, I'll speak with Republican U.S. House candidate Rod Miller. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Rod Miller has worked as a cowboy on the staffs of Governor Ed Hirschler and Mike Sullivan, was a small businessman, and became a ranch manager. Now he wants to become a member of Congress and is challenging Liz Cheney in the Republican primary. Miller is a colorful candidate, but is very serious about this election. He joins me in the studio where we begin our conversation talking about what to do about immigration.
In a nutshell, a country that is sending jobs overseas and importing people is always going to be in trouble. And immigration is a huge problem right now. I hearken back to Al Simpson and Romano Mazzoli in the late 80s, their bill, which basically said, okay, people are here illegally, we'll give them a clear path to citizenship, provided they haven't broken any other laws, and we're going to tighten up our borders, and we're going to go after employers who are bringing these people in. There was no political will to follow through on that. Hence, we're in the situation we have now. So I hearken back to the wisdom of Simpson Mazzoli as a solution. But again, I think Congress has to step up to the plate.
It, when you look at what the administration is doing, and sometimes it's hard to figure some of these things out, what they're actually up to, but it does really seem like they want to go after the people who are here illegally and just send them back and not get them in. So what's the compromise there? What's the way you'd like to see this all work out?
Strict border control. Whether you're an amnesty seeker or whether you just want to come into the country for a job, let's get that work done at the border rather than let people in and deal with them ex post facto when they're already here without documentation.
What did you think about what was going on, the separation of the kids and all of that?
It's inhumane to weaponize children. Good God. Come on, Bob. Give me a break.
Well, I'm just asking your opinion on that.
Yeah, it was inhumane. Mm-hmm. we as a country should be better than that. We should not resort to using 10 and 12-year-olds as a pawn in an immigration policy that we don't have the wisdom or political will to craft for ourselves. So, end of sermon.
Do you see this getting solved anytime soon?
I do. I absolutely do. It's not going to be easy. Like I mentioned Simpson-Mazzola, this has been going on for decades. But it's going to come to a head, and we're going to have to solve it. Otherwise, it's going to become a political pawn that is constantly tossed back and forth between the parties, and it's going to distract us from the really important work that this country has to do.
Rob Miller visiting with us. He is a Republican candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives. Well, here's an easy one for you. Tell me about how you're going to fix health care and this. Do you start again? Do you continue to work on what's called Obamacare? Where do we go from here? Because obviously the Republicans took a whack at it and they didn't get anywhere.
This is another one, Bob, that's been floating around since Lyndon Johnson's Great Society tried to take a whack at health care. And yes, it's constitutional. And in the preamble, it says promoting the general welfare is one of the raison d'etre for government. So we have to get at that nut somehow. Philosophically, I believe that, yes, government has a role to play in making sure that our citizens are healthy. How we do that is where we've been cutting the cheese all along the process. If you're looking at insurance, the cheapest insurance is that insurance policy that is spread out over the greatest number of people. Actuarial fact, the premiums are less, the risk is spread out over a greater area, and you have a more effective policy. Insurance is only one of the areas of healthcare that we need to deal with. The other one is the cost of drugs, a pharmaceutical industry that is using its political and monetary clout to get its way through Congress, a Food and Drug Administration that oftentimes acts more as a cheerleader for big pharma than it does for consumers. So we've got a lot of work to do, but again, it's like immigration. We need to get it done.
Senator Enzi has said from time to time when he's backed off of the politics, but he said from time to time that really the best way to go here is to focus on a few things and then get those resolved, and then you take another step. So it's small bites. Do you agree with that approach?
I do. Case in point, Hillary Clinton's health care initiative at the very beginning of Bill Clinton's term, big heal-all, fix-all, omnibus sort of health care thing that fell flat on its face. I don't think that's the way to do it. I think our political will is there to take those small bites of the elephant and eat it slowly.
Where do we get this? How do you see solving the drug issue? Because you have so many in Congress who, just check the numbers in campaigns that are getting worked pretty hard to not bring drugs from out of the country in here, and which obviously would reduce costs and that kind of thing. It's such a well-lobbied issue. How do you get something like that through and resolve it?
Why are those senators and representatives resisting that? It's because their contributions and the political influence from huge pharmaceutical companies. If there is a cheaper generic alternative to a drug produced by Big Pharma that does just as well, why not bring it into the country and let consumers decide which one they want to buy?
The other thing I'm sure you hear, Rod, on the campaign trail, and we've heard it for years, is this whole cost issue and just getting it under control. And boy, I recently got a chance to look at some medical bills and just reviewing what they were. And boy, this costs this, this costs that, unless you have insurance, and then it'll cost this, and then it'll cost that. How do we get just a handle on what the real costs are for healthcare?
That's a difficult one, Bob. On the drug and medication side of it, I think we have some more tools in our toolkit to deal with that. When it comes to the cost for a stay in an emergency room or intensive care unit, something like that, I don't know how we get a handle on those costs. I would not say that it's time for the government to step in and tell hospitals or doctors what they should charge, but that is every bit as an important component of the healthcare question, as is insurance.
Congress, especially the House of Representatives, just recently looked at a number of pieces of legislation on opioid abuse and maybe some reforms in that area. I'm curious if you had a chance to look at any of that and then what you think about where they're going or what you would like to see in that particular area.
Yeah, I've seen any number of studies on opioid abuse. And we have pharmaceutical companies out there that are producing and marketing the fentanyls and the opioids and drugs of a similar nature that are addicting people. And then that pharmaceutical company comes up with an antidote for an overdose and markets that. That's crazy policy. The opioids and the hard drugs, heroin, meth, those drugs that do real harm to people should be included in the Food and Drug Administration schedule of dangerous drugs because they are by definition dangerous. Cannabis, on the other hand, I think should be off the schedule of FDA dangerous drugs. Left up to the states whether or not to regulate it, legalize it, or whatever. But that cannabis legalization represents a source of potential revenue to deal with the effects on society from opioids and those other hard drugs.
Rob Miller visiting with us. He's a Republican candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives. Rob, one area that I know you've worked hard on over the years, and that's been on land use issues, and we're seeing the Trump administration take a look at wilderness areas and possibly removing some of those areas. I'm curious where you see what you think of what they're up to and what might be a better way to get at some of the things they're getting at. I imagine it's for
there, oil and gas Bob, there's a microcosm and a macrocosm answer to that question. Let's deal with the wilderness study areas, which are in the BLM planning process. And they've been there for 20 or 30 years. They have wilderness characteristics or were when the planning process evolved and came to fruition. Now it's time to look at those and decide, what are we going to do? Are we going to include them in our Wyoming wilderness system or release them for multiple use, either hard release or soft release? What is the mix of things that are going to happen on that? We should do that. There's no problem. I have no problem at all with looking at the BLM wilderness areas. The Wyoming County Commissioners Association had initiated a process at the county level to do just that, put together a collaborative group of on-the-ground folks to look at WSAs in their locale and come up with some recommendations. Representative Cheney has backdoored that process and introduced legislation that would do what some of those folks were talking about. I think that's counterproductive. That is removing the wisdom of the local people and replacing it with wisdom from Congress. That's on the wilderness study areas. That's my sermon.
Tariffs. We're talking about those things and you know, renegotiating a bunch of these agreements that we've had in the past. Your thoughts on that?
I think that's a situation, Bob, where Congress has punted some of its constitutional authority to an executive branch. And the executive elected every 4 years is much more prone to the winds of political change that happen. Congress, on the other hand, should be more stable over the course of time and should exercise our international commerce activities, just like the Constitution says. Tariffs can have huge blowback. If we get mad at an Asian country for producing cheap steel, cheap aluminum, and dump it here, and we put tariffs on that, they're going to put tariffs on, and they're targeting red state businesses now, ag businesses, and trying to hurt the folks who are the president's supporters on the tariff. So there's huge blowback.
Now, the president will tell you, if we were to bring him in here and visit with us, but he would say that the reason you do this is to negotiate some better trade deals and that the U.S. has not done well with trade deals over the years. Do you think he's right on that?
I do. I think tariffs, duties, trade wars are symptoms of an utter failure in our economic diplomacy, which is where those decisions should be made. Those deals should be cut. And those are long-term. If he's not satisfied with the trade deals we're in, he certainly has the ability to go in there and through our trade representative and head of the Department of Commerce, try and rearrange those. But to abrogate them and start slapping tariffs on people, that's going to come back and hurt folks in Wyoming.
Rod Miller, he is a Republican candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives. Thank you for stopping by.
Bob, thanks for having me in. It's always a pleasure coming to the flagship of everything that's groovy in Wyoming.
When we come back, we'll have a series of stories about how current immigration laws are impacting the tourism economy and whether a solution is on the horizon. This is Open Spaces. You are listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. The travel and hospitality industry is the second largest industry in Wyoming. As tourists flood to the state in the summer, the industry relies on seasonal workers to keep things running smoothly. But more and more, seasonal workers have been harder to come by in the local workforce, so businesses depend on visa programs that bring in foreign guest workers. The two most commonly used are the J-1 visa, which sponsors students, and the H-2B visa, which brings in workers to fill in temporary, non-agricultural positions. The visa process is complicated, and it's causing problems for Wyoming's tourism communities that depend heavily on legal immigrants for their summer workforce. For Cody, it's just getting the workers in the first place. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska has more.
Cody prides itself for its Western hospitality, so it's very important to the hotels to provide an enjoyable experience. James Blair is the chief operating officer of three hotels in Cody. He says in order to provide that kind of service, he needs to be fully staffed.
But what's our option? You know, to just be short-staffed and not be able to deliver good service and clean rooms and good food and whatever. So it's kind of like, whether you like it or not, that's what you have to do to maybe get workforce.
He needs legal immigrants to have a full workforce. This includes 60 housekeepers total. And out of those 60, he depends on the H-2B visa workers to fill 25 positions. The H-2B visa allows U.S. businesses to bring in foreign workers to fill temporary housekeeping, maintenance, and construction jobs. But businesses need to prove that they are not able to get enough local workers.
The common misconceptions, like around town, is that, oh, you know, you're bringing in these foreign workers, you know, instead of hiring our kids or instead of hiring locals. It's simply not true. We hire all the locals that we possibly can that are employable, and it's not enough.
But Blair started to run into some problems with the H-2B visa 2 years ago.
Last year, we were basically completely out in the cold, didn't get any workers.
And Blair wasn't the only business unable to get all the workers they applied for. This was thanks to Congress changing a rule. Now, returning workers would be included in the annual 66,000 cap of visas given out, substantially decreasing the number of workers allowed in the states, making it difficult for a number of Wyoming businesses to get what they need. As mentioned before, people are not available locally. Sam Russell is an H-2B visa worker and is the housekeeping manager for Sunset Properties, which owns the two Best Westerns in Cody.
You can find like 10 persons to work locally like for this month, and by the middle of the month, five or six of them is
gone. Local businesses find that H-2B workers are much more reliable than other visa programs. Tina Hobel-Henrich, the executive director of Cody Country Chamber of Commerce, says because most H-2B visa workers return year after year, they know the lay of the land, so there's less need for orienting workers.
What we lack are the resources for training, learning and development. Those are things that typically the owner is going to have to step in and do.
Both Blair Hotels and Sunset Properties are trying to raise this issue to Wyoming's congressional delegation. James Blair with Blair Hotels says something needs to be done soon.
I don't care how they achieve it, but it just seems like the amount of workers that they'll allow in is not enough to cover the need.
Unfortunately, it probably won't be fixed by next year. And so businesses are already worried about next summer. Will they get any workers at all? So just in case, they are looking at different options. One possible option is the J-1 visa program, which brings foreign students into the country. But Blair says that's not a very good one.
The J-1 students that come over, I don't think their primary reason for being here is working. Their primary reason for being here is to sightsee. I think that's great. It's just not as strong of a work ethic or maybe an intention of why they're here.
But Blair can't be picky at the moment and is willing to do what he can to avoid being short-staffed for a third year in a row. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
In Jackson, foreign workers are very important to the tourism industry as well. But business leaders in the community say the difficulty in maintaining a stable workforce doesn't lie specifically in the visa process, but it's still important. Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard reports.
Walk around Jackson this summer, and you can expect to see a few things. Lots of people, lots of traffic, and lots of help wanted signs.
I would agree if you walk around, that is the impression. The business owners I've spoken to would say, oh yes, we're always one or two less than what we want.
That's Anna Olson, the president and CEO of the Jackson Hole Chamber of Commerce.
Everyone wants to do a good thing and provide good customer service. So I think there's always that sense of, oh, if we just had one more.
But despite all the signs, Olson says she's heard from businesses that the flow of visa workers has actually been pretty steady this year. That's because Jackson relies heavily on foreign student workers. That's known as the J-1 visa program.
We have a fortunate situation in some ways that our J-1 visa situation has been reliable this year. And talking to some resorts and talking to some individual small town businesses and retailers, they have seen either J-1s returning or new J-1s here. And it hasn't been a great source of concern actually getting people into jobs.
Jackson has moved away from the much more cumbersome H-2B visa program in favor of student workers. And unlike Cody, Jackson has had good luck with those workers. The reasons businesses in Jackson are having trouble finding workers is simple. It's hard to find adequate and affordable housing in Jackson.
What we're hearing is more that the cost of living is one of the biggest challenges. Cost of rents. Rents are rising in Jackson.
According to the Wyoming Economic Analysis Division, the average two-bedroom unfurnished apartment in Jackson costs a little over $1,900 a month. But the other problem is there aren't a lot of available places to rent. Clarine Law runs Town Square Inns, a group of family-owned hotels in Jackson. She says her businesses have been able to hire enough workers this summer, but housing presents a challenge.
I see that if we can address housing, I think it solves a great deal of this problem.
Law says Town Square Inns has been forced to provide employee housing for a fee.
We actually put up about 100 people in the summertime. It's not great. You know, you just dormitory, whatever you can do. But without some sort of housing, it's very difficult to recruit.
Law has been a business owner since 1962. Back then, she says her family did a lot of the work themselves. Cleaning rooms, folding laundry, and keeping the books. And when the season was over, they got a break. The tourism season back then was shorter.
There was a time that we used to put a sign up right after Labor Day and say, gone fishing. And I'd take the children down the Snake River and sit on a gravel bank and catch trout. Those days are long past.
That's because there are more visitors year-round, and hiring local workers is not an option. As of May 2018, Wyoming had a 3.7% unemployment rate and the lowest population of any state in the country. Chris Brown, the executive director of the Wyoming Lodging and Restaurant Association, says those two things mean the businesses have to turn to guest worker programs. While the issue of housing is being worked on locally, Brown says immigration reform in Congress is critical.
Our country as a whole hasn't addressed comprehensive immigration reform. There's a real need for foreign workers in the United States. There's simply, there's certain jobs that Americans, there either aren't enough Americans or they're unwilling to fill those jobs.
Hotel owner Clarine Law has spoken to Wyoming's congressional delegation about the need for more avenues for legal immigration. She says she wants a year-round stable workforce, and seeing her employees achieve green cards is part of that.
Sometimes it's taken them as much as 8 years of going and coming legally. That's the kind of program I want to encourage, but I want to shorten the time span. And I, you know, to have the proper vetting done and to have them contributing members of the United States of America.
So while adding student employees in Jackson has worked, many businesses admit they would like something a little more stable. But it may take a congressional solution to get there. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caroline Ballard.
This month, babies being ripped away from their parents dominated the immigration debate in Washington. But Wyoming lawmakers are hoping the conversation can turn to the state's need for guest workers. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
Republican leaders on Capitol Hill tried to avoid any immigration debate this election year. But moderate Republicans in the House forced party leaders to bring up legislation to deal with the so-called Dreamers, those kids brought here by their undocumented parents. Then Trump changed the conversation when officials started forcefully separating children from their parents. Wyoming Senator Mike Enzi says he's glad the president eventually ended that family separation policy on his own, though lawmakers may still have to pass a bill to ensure no president does that again.
That's a huge change, and now there are people trying to figure out, there are probably half a dozen different bills that people want their name on in order to do it, and I'll be looking at all of them, and I think that some kind of a solution will be arrived at.
Enzi and others are now hoping the conversation can move to the biggest needs back home, visas for guest workers.
That's been a consistent problem in Wyoming. We have a lot of people that are experts in certain areas that come in for a short period of time and then go back to their countries, and they fill a definite need in Wyoming. And one of the difficulties is they keep trying to downsize the quotas.
Enzi says he's been glad to hear Trump call for a better system of targeted visas for guest workers, instead of the current visa lottery that randomly puts immigrants from across the globe in line for a visa.
I did notice that the president was also saying that we want the kind of skills that we need in the country. And that's something that I've been pushing for a long time, too. Instead of just a flat first come, first serve, there are needs that we have, and we ought to fill those needs first.
Most Democrats also want more high-skilled and specialty visas, but they want other things, too. So they aren't willing to address the guest workers without addressing some other issues, too.
Yeah, then we have no leverage.
That's Arizona Democrat Raul Grijalva. He says his community desperately needs more temporary visas, but he says his party will only support that if the GOP deals with Dreamers and the Trump administration's family separation policy.
All the growers there in the ranching communities in Arizona, all the ranchers, and you keep going all across this country, anywhere where there's significant agriculture, they need guest workers. But a standalone bill without dealing with the Dreamer Act and without dealing with even the soul separation issue, I'm not even asking for comprehensive reform. I'm dealing with those two things.
Democrats in the GOP have been locked in a battle over border funding, especially over the president's demands for wall funding. But Republicans say they also want to turn the debate to bringing in the workers that are desperately needed into the country. Here's Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney.
Well, you know, we are in a situation today, I think, where we've got to both stop the illegal immigration, we got to secure our border, but we also have to fix our legal immigration system.
Now with the unemployment rate so low, there are actually many job openings that many Americans are too skilled for, which Cheney says is a huge problem.
You know, people say the system is not working as well as it should. The system doesn't allow us to be able to bring people temporarily. The government hasn't been as responsive as they need to be, particularly in circumstances where a lot of these folks have tried to find Americans to do these jobs and haven't been able to. And so they're faced with a situation where they can't find people to do the work that they need to have done.
Even though Democrats like Congressman Grijalva support the call for new visas for workers, they say they're not going to allow the GOP majorities to only pass an immigration bill that's low-hanging fruit.
That is cherry-picking.
But Cheney and other Republicans don't trust Democrats these days.
I think that, you know, you've got a situation as we get closer to the election where there sometimes is a lot of lip service paid by folks on the Democratic side to cooperating to get things done. But then when you look at what's actually going on, they're not too interested in doing that.
With trust so low on Capitol Hill, it seems unlikely a new bipartisan guest worker visa program can pass the Senate as a standalone bill. And Republican leaders are eager to turn their attention to any issue other than immigration, which means Wyoming's ranching and hospitality industries may feel the brunt of Washington inaction this election year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we come back, a story about food security. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Wyomingites once grew food in gardens or hunted it in the mountains. These days, though, more rural people are driving distances to reach a grocery or mini-mart for their food. It's led to nearly 75,000 people in Wyoming struggling with hunger and access to healthy, fresh foods. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, now farmers' markets and nutrition groups in the state are collaborating to start a council to address the state's food security issues.
We walk deep into a City of Gillette garage to where several old newspaper dispensers sit, but they're about to be repurposed into food dispensers instead.
Let me move them out for you.
Okay. And they're
not too heavy. So a lot of the free little pantries will say something like, take what you need, leave what you can.
That's Gillette Farmers Market co-director Megan McManaman. She's one of a group of women from all sorts of nonprofits and agencies working together on a program called Sharing the Harvest to help low-income families have better access to locally grown foods. Market co-director slash farmer Erin Galloway plans to grow veggies on her ranch to help fill the pantries.
But things like root crops, like beets and carrots, will have a longer shelf life. In the fall, winter squashes and things like edible pumpkins will do really well for long periods of time.
Sensible Nutrition's Beth Chappelle says they'll post these pantries in local parks and fill them with food, or even toothbrushes or toys that people can help themselves to. A local auto body shop painted them bright red and yellow. Chappelle's favorite is the blue sparkly.
That's my first favorite.
That one looks like fingernail polish.
Isn't that fancy?
And Chappelle says making them fancy sends a message.
We want it to be very comfortable for people so they don't have that stigma attached to it that they may not have what they need.
And right now, what many people in Gillette need is healthy food.
With the downturn in the coal that we had in the last couple of years, there has been a little bit of an uptick in that. More people qualifying, more people having some food insecurity.
Chappelle says a new study found that 2,200 families in Gillette aren't able to fill their basic needs. This isn't just a problem in Gillette, though. Hunger affects the whole state. Albany County actually has the highest rate. 17% of the population lacks access to good food there, many of them college students. The Wind River Reservation and Uinta counties suffer too. And it's the children in those places that feel the hunger pangs the worst, according to a report by Feeding America. These rates have prompted food groups like Gillette's Sharing the Harvest to go in search of statewide collaborators. Farmers Market Director McManaman.
We're probably all working on the same things, but if we could just communicate more and just build those partnerships, I think we could all find that it would be beneficial for everybody.
So recently, their group traveled to a summit in Casper to meet with a growing network of food activists. The Wind River Reservation's Growing Resilience Project was there, and Casper's Food for Thought Project. Those groups also grow gardens and work with farmers markets as a way to feed the hungry. Casper's Food for Thought director Jamie Purcell takes me on a tour of their kitchens and gardens.
So we like to call this the urban farm rather than the community garden because we do a lot more than just growing, but as you can see, we've got community garden beds out here.
And some of this food ends up going out to feed the hungry. Down in the bag packing kitchen, she shows me where volunteers come every Wednesday.
We can pack 700 bags in about 20 minutes. We've got it down to a system.
But she says it's not enough to make sure people are on food stamps.
It means so much more than just having food, quote unquote, on the table, but it's really more about healthy food and culturally appropriate food and food that you know how to cook or you know how to preserve.
University of Wyoming Community and Public Health Professor Christine Porter helped organize the summit. She says when people buy and eat food grown by local producers, they're healthier and it diversifies the economy.
Which is a huge priority right now. Food is one of the most powerful ways to do it. That's what other states are doing, and that's what other food policy councils help create.
That's what these groups all hope to organize, a food policy council that could get all parts of Wyoming's food system speaking to each other, lawmakers, grocers, farmers, and eaters.
If a voice is missing or not having negotiating power at such a council, it is often the voice of people who are struggling with food insecurity.
Wyoming is the only state that doesn't have such a council. Gillette Farmers Market Director McManaman says a council could make big changes by advocating for small farmers and the people they feed. She'd like to see a council make sure all Wyoming farmers markets take food stamps or get local foods in schools and other state agencies.
We want to partner with people that are ready and willing to like make some change, and let's like revolutionize the local food economy in Wyoming.
The first step in that revolution, McManaman says, is getting food in people's hands. Those sparkly little food pantries will be unveiled in parks around Gillette after a food drive to fill them July 14th. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
I really did like that color.
This summer, we're taking you on a tour of some of our favorite public lands. Nowhere in our region is more public than our country's oldest iconic national park, Yellowstone. Every summer, millions of people flock there from around the world to take in the beauty, the geysers, and as Nate Hedgie reports, the wildlife.
I'm a night owl, so 6:30 in the morning is pretty early for me. But apparently that's one of the best times to watch wildlife in Yellowstone National Park.
I'm walking past bison paddies. It's really, really cold early morning. Bison paddies meaning buffalo poop.
I climb to the top of a hill and join a bunch of retirees staring through high-powered telescopes at a lush, verdant hill.
So keep watching just to the right of the tree.
That's Carol Rickman. She's trying to help me spot a wolf den. But all I see are some rocks, a black raven, and a bare gray aspen tree.
Just look about a third of the way down to the tree to the right.
Third of the way down. Oh, yep, there they go. Oh, no. That's so cute.
One of the gray pups.
And is it the mom lying down?
Yes.
In the white? Okay, and I just saw a little gray pup run down, and it was kind of unbearably cute. The baby wolf is in the grass, toppling over himself as his mom looks on. And even though I'm looking through a $1,000 scope, the wolves are still kind of hard to see. They blend into the jagged purple rocks and minty sage. But when they start wrestling around, like they're doing right now, they look like big, scruffy dogs. And that's one of the reasons why Rickman loves coming here to Yellowstone to watch wolves.
I'm really into dogs, so, you know, it's kind of the wild extension of watching your dog.
And looking around, I see at least 50 people perched up on hills or leaning against their cars watching the wolves. It's a misty, wet morning, so some folks are wearing raincoats, and you can smell wet dirt and fresh sage. Their eyes are all trained on the wolves.
It's almost like watching a TV series.
It is. It's like watching a soap opera.
But this Yellowstone soap opera doesn't just star wolves. There's also bighorn sheep, pronghorn antelope, and grizzly bears. That's what another couple is looking at right now. They wave me over.
Oh, there's a grizzly?
Yeah, they're on the ridge, very far away.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I guess that's a courting pair.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
look at the size.
They're huge.
They're awesome.
We're looking at two enormous brown grizzly bears. They look wet, probably from the morning dew, and they're pawing at the ground near a snowbank.
Yeah, what are they digging for?
I have no idea.
I guess we could just suppose. I imagine they're digging for grubs and insects because that's kind of what they snack on.
I'll try to find
it. It's about 8 o'clock in the morning now, and the whole valley is alive with animals. Some bighorn sheep are perched on a nearby mountain. A small herd of bison move through the grass and sage. There's even some of my favorite animals, pronghorn antelope. They may be the fastest running animal in North America, but they kind of look like overweight goats. Mike Engel is visiting from Pennsylvania and is nice enough to train his scope on one trotting across a dirt road.
I think that they're amazing.
Yeah, they're cool.
Yeah, they are. They are.
I love the colors on them, the sounds they make.
Pronghorn?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's weird. It's a goat sound. It sounds like a goat.
The sun is starting to break through the clouds, and it's getting warmer. The pronghorn disappears into the tall grass. And soon the wolves will bed down for the afternoon, and the grizzly bears will find a good place to lounge in the shade. And for a while, most of the animals in Yellowstone National Park will become quiet and still. The only sound, the click, click, click of tourists taking pictures of grazing bison and elk at the nation's oldest national park. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in the Lamar Valley, Wyoming.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show or want to hear an individual segment, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces.
You'll never miss the show if you sign up for our podcast on that website or on iTunes. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We're always looking for good ideas for interviews or stories. Love to hear from you. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.